Lena Kako, greetings everyone. You're tuned in to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and beyond with your host, Ke Haolani Kawanui. This show is produced in the studios of WESU Middletown, Connecticut, also known as Mattabesset, the homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. Indigenous Politics features cultural and political issues facing Native American and other Indigenous peoples. On today's show, you will hear part one of a two-part series that features panel presentations from an event held on February 27th at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center on tribal sovereignty. This event was organized by the senior researcher of the museum, Jason Mancini. I served as moderator of the event, and on today's selection of part one, you will hear my introduction to the panel, as well as presentations from John Echohawk and Cedric Woods. Part two will feature the three other panelists, Betsy Conway, James Jackson, and Jackson King. The biographical notes will be heard before each individual presentation. And before we turn to that, I want to let listeners know that all of our shows are archived online at indigenouspolitics.com. And also, I want to let you know my email address. I can receive your feedback on the show. The address is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. Now, let's turn to the program again, starting off with my opening remarks as moderator, and then presentations by John Echohawk and Cedric Woods for this part one of a two-part series. Aloha kako, valina kako, greetings everyone. It's very good to be here. Thank you for the introduction. It's good to be here on Mashantucket Pequot Sovereign Land. It is an honor to be here to have the opportunity to moderate this panel of individuals of such high caliber and expertise. Before I introduce our esteemed participants, I want to offer some brief comments in order to frame this session on tribal sovereignty and the meaning of it today. On Tuesday of this week, a local paper called The Day published a short article titled "Controversial Sovereignty Issue to be Explored in Panel Discussion" by Brian Hollenbeck. At first, I was excited to see the local paper address this event until I took a look at the online comments section to see the reader's feedback. Unfortunately, this section was riddled with ignorant, hostile, and racist comments regarding not only the event, but tribal sovereignty in general and Mashantucket Pequots in particular. As I studied these missives, I noticed how familiar they are to me, since much of the same reactionary rhetoric can be found online when I read the Honolulu Advertiser and the Honolulu Star Bulletin, where Hawaii residents vent and characterize Native Hawaiians, our sovereignty claims, and even our existence as a people as insubstantial and inauthentic. Like the comments I read in The Day, they are prime examples of what I call and am theorizing as imperialist resentment. In the comments regarding today's event, Larry Green, founder of Preston Residents Against Annexation, wrote several postings, but one snippet I want to read to you is this assertion. He stated, quote, "The recognition of tribes is unconstitutional because all Indians are American citizens and no law should treat them differently." David Irons wrote, quote, "It would seem to me and probably many others that if they were authentic, they would have been able to obtain recognition the normal and recognized BIA process way. When they were unable to qualify that way, they managed to get some politicians to grant recognition by congressional decree. It looked shady and dishonest then, and it still does today. We were born here too. That makes us just as native as the next guy. Where is our recognition and permission to steal from the public?" End quote. An anonymous writer identified as MAS suggested, quote, "Since the beginning of time, there have been wars over land, over cultural differences, over religion, and the list goes on. We can't change the past and all that took place in the growth of this great country of the United States of America. The tribal entity is no different than any other ethnic group that has suffered during the process of the birth of this great nation. The issue at hand is that we all should live under one government, and we should all adhere to its laws as one group, Americans." End quote. And a man identified as Robert with no surname asked, "Tell me again how all men are created equal.
I want to open my own casino, and I want it on the grounds of L&M Hospital, where my brother and I were born. It's our family's historical birthplace. I am indigenous to New London." End quote. I recount these excerpts here today to get at some of these issues and put them right out on the table, since they're so prevailing in our settler colonial society today. What strikes me most about all four of these that I've selected is that the question of tribal sovereignty is misread through a twisted notion of racial equality that denies both colonialism and racial oppression and domination. For indigenous peoples in the United States, in addition to indigenous and non-indigenous peoples in the U.S. territories, the political project of civil rights throughout the last 40 years has been burdened, due to the history of U.S. settler colonialism, with distinctly different relationships to the nation state. Additionally, there are different types of citizenship, given the history of forced inclusion within the United States as the American Republic appropriated indigenous territories in the service of imperialist expansion. Issues relating to territory, sovereignty, and nationhood structure colonized people's relationship to the nation state and make for radically different goals than those that emerge from the project of civil rights. Civil rights are, by definition, fundamentally about equality under the law, equal protection, equal access, and equal opportunity. The conflation of race and indigeneity is the struggle American Indians face in confronting challenges to their distinct legal status that presume their rights are based on racial privileges rather than political formations as nations. Lumbee legal scholar David E. Wilkins outlines four realities that set American Indians apart from racial minorities in the United States. First, American Indians were the original inhabitants of what is now considered the United States. This is the premise of original occupancy. Second, this pre-existence, original occupancy, necessitated the negotiation of political compacts, treaties, and alliances with European nations and the United States. That's the political relationship piece. Third, as recognized sovereigns, Indian peoples are subject to the U.S. Trust Doctrine, which is supposed to be a unique legal relationship with the U.S. federal government that entails protection. Finally, stemming from the trust relationship, the United States asserts plenary power over tribal nations that it deems exclusive and preemptive. The latter issue is the most difficult due to the ways in which the U.S. judiciary has interpreted the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution to mean full and total power over tribal nations. The clause gives Congress the power to, quote, regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes, end quote. In other words, the U.S. federal government will not allow any state or foreign nation to interfere in commerce with tribal nations, since the government reserves the right to interact in a nation-to-nation capacity. The U.S. Constitution also includes a formula for determining the apportionment for representatives to Congress and direct taxes, quote, excluding Indians not taxed, end quote. And that is an excerpt from the U.S. Constitution. Here, the constitutional phrase specifically makes a distinction between tribal Indians having no relationship to the states and individual Indians considered at that time to be regular citizens over whom the states might extend tax liabilities. This is forged through the work of also not only David E. Wilkins, but his collaborative work with the late Vine Deloria Jr. In other words, the Constitution acknowledges the separation of tribal governments and their citizens from other U.S. citizens. Of course, this might seem complicated by the fact that the United States unilaterally granted citizenship to American Indians finally in 1924. Prior to that, some Indian peoples had been made in piecemeal fashion, say through armed service participation or allotment. But this has meant that Indians of federally recognized tribes have dual citizenship, while Indians of non-recognized tribes are merely considered U.S. citizens of Indian ancestry from whatever nation. As Lenape scholar Joanne Marie Barker documents and analyzes, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988 served as a catalyst for a renewed political opposition to Native sovereignty movements throughout the United States. Furthermore, she notes that the use of reverse racism arguments challenges laws recognizing Native rights to sovereignty and self-determination. As such, the racialization of Native peoples as both special interest groups and racial minorities is used to undermine, to undercut the unique status of Indigenous peoples under U.S. federal law and international law. This challenging political terrain creates the need for multiple interventions on different fronts when challenging the logic and workings of settler colonialism and how the logic of capital functions in relation to settler colonialism. I see this panel as one such much needed intervention. Our first speaker is John Echohawk, a member of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. He is co-founder of the Native American Rights Fund, which he co-founded in 1970, and he's been its executive director since 1977. The Native American Rights Fund has been involved in most of the major Indian rights litigation since 1970. He serves on many national boards and has received numerous service awards and other recognition for his leadership in the Indian law field. In 1992, he served on the Clinton-Gore transition team for the Department of the Interior, and in 2008, he served on the Obama-Biden transition team for the Department of the Interior. He earned his Bachelor's of Arts at the University of New Mexico in 1967, his Juris Doctorate at University of New Mexico in 1970, and was admitted to practice law in Colorado. Please help me welcome John Echohawk.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be invited to participate in this panel here this afternoon. It's good to be back at Mashantucket again. I've been involved in advising and representing Mashantucket off and on different issues over the years since 1976. So it's always good to kind of come home and see people I've been working with for a long time. The subject of the panel, sovereignty, I think is really a good one, because if you don't understand tribal sovereignty, then you don't understand Indians. It's as simple as that. We're all about sovereignty, and if you don't know about sovereignty, then you don't know about us. Our own U.S. Supreme Court in many cases has recognized that our Indian nations are the oldest sovereigns on this continent. Our sovereignty predates the sovereignty of the United States government and the several states. Supreme Court law. The history of our sovereign Indian nations, of course, goes back to time immemorial. We have been here forever. But most of the history people know about began in 1492 with the first contact. That history, of course, has a lot of unfortunate historical episodes of conflict. Some other good things, some other things that are good, but a lot of conflict. And more often than not, these conflicts were resolved through treaties. Treaties between the European nations and our tribal nations, because the European nations came to understand our peoples as sovereigns, as nations. And treaties are made between nations. And there were many, many treaties made between our nations and the European nations in this period from 1492 to 1787. So it's not surprising in 1787, when the United States Constitution was adopted, that it recognized the sovereignty of our tribal nations. It gives Congress the power to deal with the various sovereigns, the foreign nations, the states, and the Indian nations. The U.S. Supreme Court had its first occasion to interpret the Constitution and talk about the status of Indian nations and some cases that came up from Cherokee country involving the state of Georgia in 1831 and 1832. The U.S. Supreme Court was asked to hear a case between the Cherokee Nation and the state of Georgia under its original jurisdiction, which gives it gives the court power to hear cases between foreign nations. So the question was, is the Cherokee Nation a foreign nation? And could they sue the state of Georgia under original jurisdiction? Supreme Court said, no, it's not a foreign nation, but it's a domestic dependent nation recognized in the Constitution as a sovereign, but a different kind of sovereign, a domestic dependent nation, not a foreign nation, but under the protection of the United States, but a sovereign government nonetheless, subject to federal authority. The Supreme Court the next year did take a case that got to the issue at heart, and that is whether the laws of the state of Georgia applied on the Cherokee lands in within the boundaries of the state of Georgia, and the court held no, that the states do not have any jurisdiction on Indian land within Indian country because state law has no force and effect in Indian country. It's a matter of federal law and tribal law. And those cases are still good today. The United States government continued to deal with tribes through treaties until 1871, when it came to the attention of the House of Representatives that they really had no role in the treaty-making policy dealing with tribes, because under our Constitution, the treaties are ratified by the Senate. The Senate only, the House had no role in that, and they became upset about this. So in 1871, treaty making was ended, and from then on, relationships with the tribal nations were dealt with through agreements or acts of Congress so that the House of Representatives could be involved as well. But at the same time, they recognized that all of the treaties that had been made before 1871 were still valid and had not been changed. So we had to deal with both the Senate and the House beginning in 1871. In 1887, the Congress undertook a policy of trying to assimilate our tribal nations, and they did that through this Allotment Act that basically took some of our tribal lands on some of the of some of the tribal nations and divided them up, allotted them among the individual members, and gave them each a piece of the tribal land. That was the allotment process. They tried to make us all farmers, and along the way, some of us citizens that accepted this Allotment Act and got some of this land. Citizenship had started, but not all of us got citizenship through that process. In 1924, Congress passed the Indian Citizenship Act, which gave all of our people citizenship for the first time. Congress did this because we had so many of our people volunteering to serve in World War I and fight for this country, even though most of us were not citizens, because this is our country and we wanted to defend it, and this country was very, very impressed by that and took a hard look at its Indian policy and the fact that most of us had no citizenship. But even when they passed the Citizenship Act, they said, this does not affect Indian sovereignty or Indian treaties. Those treaties remained in full force and effect. In 1928, they released the Merriam Report. Merriam was one of the commissioners who studied Indian policy and came up with recommendations to change it, because this assimilation policy had not really worked. Our people were the poorest of the poor. We had lost almost 100 million acres of our land through this allotment process, and something had to be done. So in 1934, Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act, And what that allowed us to do was to reorganize our tribal governments. Many of them had fallen into disuse since it was the Bureau of Indian Affairs who had been running our affairs on our lands for so long, to the exclusion of our tribal governments, our traditional tribal governments. So this Indian Reorganization Act allowed us to reorganize our tribal governments and once again start governing our own people as we have always done. Unfortunately, this new era of tribal self-government didn't last all that long, because in 1953, Congress came up with a new policy, terminating our tribes, breaking all the treaties, doing away with all of our tribal governments, selling off our lands, sending us to the city. But they never asked us about that. They knew what was best for us, so they started doing that to many of our tribes. We fought back, but to no avail. They also started taking away our tribal jurisdiction over our lands and started giving state jurisdiction to many of the states where our lands were located, and disrupting our tribal governance. This was called Public Law 280. In the 1960s, our people got organized and started fighting back against these termination policies through the Office of Economic Opportunity and the War on Poverty. We started our own community action programs. We started to get some Indian lawyers. I was one of the first Indian lawyers. Of my generation, we had virtually none in the 1960s. We also got legal services on many of our reservations, and those lawyers discovered these treaties that were going unenforced and started bringing Indian litigation to enforce our treaty rights, and we started winning those cases. It became clear that we needed a national organization to lead the fight for our Indian rights, and so we started the Native American Rights Fund in 1970. We modeled it after the civil rights movement, the lawyers for the African Americans who fought for equal rights were represented by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, so we formed a Native American Legal Defense Fund, the Native American Rights Fund, and we started raising money, hiring lawyers, and representing tribes in the most important cases, and we're still doing that 40 years later. We have not won all of those cases, but we've won most of them, and it's changed the history of this country. Even though we got our start in the civil rights movement, we were not about equality, we were about treaty rights. Ask Indians in the 60s what they wanted. It wasn't the civil rights, it was the treaty rights. We wanted our treaty rights recognized and not terminated against our will. The federal courts picked up on it. Good old American law, treaties are the supreme law of the land. That's what they started doing, enforcing the treaties. And the key element in treaties is sovereignty, tribal sovereignty. Tribes are nations. In 1970, when the Native American Rights Fund was started, we also got a huge boost from, of all people, President Nixon, who became the first president to articulate an Indian policy based upon sovereignty, based upon the right of Indian people to self-determine their own futures, self-determination and treaty rights. And President Nixon rejected as wrong the termination policy and said that the United States should live up to the laws and its commitments and its obligations. And every president since President Nixon in 1970 has articulated their support for Indian self-determination, right up through Barack Obama, our current president. The Indian litigation that proliferated beginning in the 1970s had many, many important cases determined by the U.S. Supreme Court. We didn't win them all, but we won most of them. One of the ones I wanted to mention was a case in 1975 called Morton against Mancari. That was a case that challenged a federal law that gave preferential hiring in the Bureau of Indian Affairs to Indian people. It's the law Congress passed, and so the question was, well, doesn't this discriminate against non-Indian people? And the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, it does not discriminate. It carries out a federal policy supporting tribal self-determination. The designation about Indians and tribes, it's not a racial classification. It's not racial. It's political. Tribes are a political classification based on the treaties and their sovereignty. So remember that. It's a political classification. It's not a racial classification. This comes from the U.S. Supreme Court. We were involved in many, many cases at the Native American Rights Fund. One of the things that happened to us early on was the appearance at our office of some representatives of Eastern tribes. And most of us at the Native American Rights Fund and our leaders were from Western tribes, and we had the BIE map, and you know, the tribes were all located out west, and on the East Coast, no tribes listed. So we didn't know any Eastern Indians ourselves, but here they came and started talking to us and asked us to look at their claims, their history. So we did that, and it was a real eye-opener. We studied that very carefully. We basically questioned why we were recognized tribes in the West, but there were virtually no recognized tribes in the East. And we looked at the peculiar history of that. Basically, in the 13 colonies, the original 13 states, they had kind of declared to the federal government, it's hands off, even though the federal government has authority over tribes and treaty making. Don't bother us here in the original 13 states. But that's not the law. That's not the law. So all this went to court, and the judge decided these are tribes. They're entitled to recognition. This was done in the context of the land claims for the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribes in Maine. And their land claim case was eventually settled by Congress in 1980, but along the way, those tribes got their tribal recognition. And it opened up this whole tribal recognition process. One of the cases we got involved in along the way was for the Mashantucket here in 1976, a land claim case that was settled in 1983 with a land claim settlement and recognition as a tribe. And of course around here, the rest is history, and of course we're gonna be talking a lot about that here during the rest of the panel, but I wanted to just to wrap up by talking about gaming, because that's an issue in my experience that many people want to talk about when they have a discussion about tribes. It's, I think, the issue that probably most people know tribes by today. And how come tribes can do gaming? Because they're sovereign nations, they're sovereigns, they're governments. And all governments can raise governmental revenue through various devices, including gaming. And that's a power that tribal governments have. A tribal case asserting the right to do gaming to generate governmental revenues came to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1987 out of California for a California tribe in the Capizan case, and the Supreme Court ruled that tribes are sovereigns. State laws, of course, regulating gaming do not apply on Indian lands. Gaming is a tribal and a federal law issue. Tribes can game. Of course, the whole house came down around our ears right after that decision from all the states, learning that they had no authority to regulate gaming on our land. So a big compromise happened the next year in Congress, 1988, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, that requires compacts between tribes and states before the gaming can proceed. But we do have a right to gaming as tribes. So this is good old American law. We've got three sovereigns in this country: our federal government, our state governments, and our tribal governments. And it's, again, made a tremendous difference in the lives of our people, and I think it's really gotten the United States government back on track in terms of its original promises to our peoples. It's, I think, an issue that is on the minds of people around the world. The United Nations in 2007 passed the Declaration on the Rights of Indian People after about 30 years worth of discussions. And this Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples talks about the sovereignty of indigenous peoples around the world. And I think the United States is really a leader in terms of its dealings with its indigenous peoples. What's really strange in that whole process was that instead of the United States recognizing that and supporting this declaration, they opposed it. And how they can oppose that declaration and at the same time have what I think is the greatest policy dealing with indigenous peoples across the world is a real mystery. And we continue to raise that with our friends in the Obama administration every day, and one of these days that's going to change and they're going to support it. But these are issues internationally as well. So with that, let me end my presentation and turn it back to our moderator. Thank you.
You're tuned in to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. We'll return to this presentation right after these public service announcements.
Today, many of the battles that we fight are in the courtroom for our sacred right of sovereignty, so red nation rise, Native American rights fund. I can make a change in the names of my ancestors so they didn't die in vain, but together, calling the tribes to action, one nation, can you imagine? Grandma once said our people will thrive, 500 years and we still survive. NARF, the Indian Wars never ended, the only changed venue to be continued.
The Native American Rights Fund. Visit NARF.org.
Nishnabe in da Makwado dem Ganoje Kaning and Donjaba Neseyapanewin in da. I am Anishinaabe, Bear Clan, from Bay Mills, and I have asthma. Mom, Dad, Grandma, Grandpa, I know that you want to do all the things you can to help me, but you might not know about all the different stuff that can make me have an asthma attack, or all the simple things you can do to fight my asthma. Please don't smoke in the house or the car, because secondhand smoke triggers my asthma attacks. If you put my teddy bear in the freezer, it will wipe out the dust mites, and if you dry off my rubber duckies and bath toys, you will get rid of mold, all the things that can cause an attack.
These are just a few of the many things that you can do to help your child fight their asthma attacks. To discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. A public service message brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Zamgaween, Nawijayasi, Gigon, Bish, and Yazik.
Because I don't want to feel like a fish with no water.
And we're back on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. And here we turn to the second panelist. This is me introducing Cedric Woods.
Our next speaker is Dr. Cedric Woods, a citizen of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. He combines over a decade of tribal government experience and research and currently serves as the interim director for the Institute of New England Native American Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. The purpose of the Institute is to connect Native New England with university research, innovation, and education. Currently, he is working on projects with tribes in the areas of tribal government capacity building, Indian education, economic development, and chronic disease prevention. Prior to arriving at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, Cedric completed a study on the evolution of tribal government among the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation. While pursuing his doctoral studies at the University of Connecticut, he served in a variety of capacities for the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation. These positions included Director of Career Development, Research Analyst, Tribal Government Spokesman, and Deputy Chief Operating Officer. He has also served as a consultant for the National Museum of the American Indian, the Haliwa Saponi Indian Tribe of North Carolina, and the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. At present, he is a member of the Board of Trustees of Plymouth Plantation, a bicultural living history museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Let's welcome him.
Thank you, Kehlani. And again, it's a delight to be back here at Mashantucket, a place which I consider home. The Connecticut Attorney General was recently quoted in Indian Country Today that he believes that federal recognition bestows a status of sovereignty that is solemn and historic, and it changes the relationship between the state and the tribe. It becomes a government-to-government relationship. I couldn't disagree more. Sovereignty is inherent to tribes. I ascribe to a view of sovereignty which I believe was first espoused by Vine Deloria Jr., who you may hear many of us reference here today, in which political or legal rights are but one expression of sovereignty. Political or legal sovereignty is the most frequently discussed, debated, and in the case of Connecticut's Attorney General, misunderstood aspect of sovereignty. Other aspects of sovereignty include economic and cultural sovereignty. My topic today is the concept of cultural sovereignty and its potential. It is especially germane to the recent experience of several regional tribes. Many tribes on the eastern seaboard are experiencing opposition to having their inherent sovereignty acknowledged by the federal government. In fact, some states, like the one we're in today, Connecticut, which have had long-standing relationships with tribes within its borders, have tried to disavow that any political relationship existed with these same tribes. Even federally recognized tribes are realizing that their legal status and their political efficacy as governments are under constant attack by their surrounding states. Given this assault on non-federally recognized or terminated tribes, both from the states in which they reside and the federal government, which does not yet acknowledge their survival, what are tribes to do? I believe that focusing on the aspect of sovereignty, which is most fully within our control as Native peoples, cultural sovereignty, is what can help us make that transition to communities that better reflect our indigenous values of living responsibly, both with one another and our place. Many non-Native folks might be thinking, if he's talking about Eastern tribes, he's talking about a lost cause. Those people don't have any culture left to preserve, protect, or to maintain to exercise cultural sovereignty. I will disagree with them also, and hopefully the examples and the framework that I talk about will give them reason to rethink their views. After all, in the words of Vine Deloria Jr., tradition cannot be a set of prescribed activities, but rather a set of processes. And at the end of the day, it is the tribal people and the audience to which this is directed. As Eastern tribal peoples, myself included, we live in communities or are surrounded by states in which we are the statistical minority. We have been exposed to colonial and later American culture since the 17th century. We've been proclaimed dead or extinct more times than we care to think about. Last of the Pequots, yet here we are today. Why are we here? How have we survived? The feds don't want us, and the states pretend we don't exist or are irrelevant. To whom do we turn to survive this onslaught of denial? In some ways, these assertions of tribal irrelevancy are more difficult to face than the old open hostility based on race, because at least then they acknowledge the boundaries that defined our communities, even if in negative terms. My belief is that we turn to ourselves, to one another, and to the sacred. We turn to cultural practices that, although changed, still bind our communities together. We rebuild and regrow our communities in the midst of the immigrants to our shores. As Deloria stated, the struggle of sovereignty is not a struggle to be free from the influence of anything outside ourselves, but a process of asserting the power we possess as communities and individuals to make decisions that affect our lives. What can and what has happened when cultural sovereignty is exercised? The examples are numerous. Language is a powerful element of community and culture. The reclamation of the Wampanoag language by the Wampanoag Nation is one example of its power. Both the federally and non-federally recognized tribes and bands made a conscious effort of nation building through language, a clear exercise in cultural sovereignty. This reclamation found its genesis in the dreams and visions of a Mashpee Wampanoag tribal member, who then went on to become an MIT-trained linguist. This choice was not an individual one, but one that received the support of the Wampanoag people. This project was started without any federal or state aid. This project would not have been successful if the Wampanoag Nation had relied on protesting or demanding funds for the project. The reclamation occurred because they engaged in constructive group action, not because the federal or state government decided they would or wouldn't recognize them or fund their language reclamation efforts. How we educate our youth is also another area in which we can assert our cultural sovereignty. A state-recognized tribe in North Carolina has been one of the innovative tribes willing to fight for the right to maintain their community and control the education of their citizens for decades. In the late 1960s, the state of North Carolina integrated the schools and eliminated the community-created Halawasapony Indian School. After the closing of their school, the tribe found that dropout rates had risen within the community and students spent almost 2 hours on the bus to attend the next closest educational institution. Using the laws established for establishing a charter school in the state of North Carolina, the tribe formed an educational task force, pursued and received a charter to operate their own school again. Under North Carolina state law, this charter came with the funding for the students. Today, they successfully still operate this community school and have done so for almost a decade, with tribal members making up the majority of its students and teachers. There are also some non-native students who live in the area who attend the school because their families prefer the community-oriented education approach used by the administrators and very involved tribal community members. A vital community institution was regained, and the educational achievements of the students at this school are consistently equal to or higher than those students in similar grades in area schools. Our deep connection as tribal people to a specific land, a specific place, an environment, is also an area where cultural sovereignty can flourish. Growing up in rural North Carolina, which my wife never lets me forget, my grandmother and other relatives included game meat like squirrel, raccoon, deer, rabbit, and fish as part of our normal everyday food. It was always with an air of excitement that I would lift the pot lid and see what Granny had cooked up. Regardless of what it was always delicious. As I have gotten older, I recognize and realize that what I was participating in was an ongoing ritual of being part of and dependent upon a local place for sustenance, both spiritual and physical. The medicines my grandmother made were not related to anything you'd get from a pharmacy. These home remedies, as I called them then, were frequently effective. These traditions of collecting plants for medicinal purposes continue on through the women in my family. Among the Mashpee, the practice of their traditional ways and methods of feeding their families and souls led to frequent conflicts with the state of Massachusetts. Massachusetts maintained that their access to traditional waterways was limited and that they needed permits to do the shell fishing they had done since they were created. Before federal recognition, the Mashpee continued to exercise their cultural sovereignty and shell fished in their traditional areas regardless of what the state thought. Ultimately, this right was recognized by the Massachusetts State Supreme Court. This was an example where an exercise of cultural sovereignty had a political or legal impact. Like today, meeting places and gatherings can also be part of our cultural sovereignty as indigenous peoples. Christianity, we all know, was one of the major forces of colonization. But instead of assimilating us, Many Eastern tribes used and adapted elements of the imposed religion into existing religious and spiritual traditions, using the same religion as a common thread to bind our community together. Many East Coast Natives have done and continue to do this through their community churches, whether it is at Shinnecock, Narragansett, Mohegan, Mashpee, Chickahominy, or Monacan. Among my folks, we accepted Christianity, but again in a context that preserves family connections and its focus on being of service to the Indian community. Pequot and Mohegan people, long before federal recognition and gaming, established a safe place for natives in Norwich, the White Cloud Indian Center, which taught beadwork classes, had books on native people that were selected by native people, and served as a place to gather. This way of creating space when few existed is also a way of remaining connected to one another and to your home, even though no one recognizes your claims to your homeland. Early in the 20th century, Eastern and Western Pequots, Mohegans, Narragansetts, and other tribes sponsored powwows and festivals across southern New England through the Algonquin Indian Association. Some of those powwows still exist today in Rhode Island. As indigenous people, we still have access to the sacred as well. The Halawasapony Indian Tribe and Monacan Tribe, both non-federally recognized, have taken Deloria's understanding of ceremony to heart. He maintained that the basis of Indian tribal religions is not preserving social forms and ceremonies, but creating new forms and ceremonies to confront new situations. In response to needs in their communities, the Halawasapony tribe reinstituted a coming-of-age ceremony for their young women, and the Monacan Indians revitalized a ceremony to rebury their ancestors on Bear Mountain, singing them home again in Tutelo, their traditional language. These new ceremonies are designed to meet the contemporary challenges of these native peoples as they travel forward into the 21st century, yet remain connected to their ancient homelands. All these examples point to native agency or cultural sovereignty. These expressions of cultural sovereignty are based on our individual and communal choices to continue to engage and be part of the natural world where we live, to reclaim our homelands, and to connect spiritually with what binds us together. In conclusion, the present situation in Indian country calls for the most intelligent and determined leadership to express itself in an unqualified endorsement of traditions and values that have always been associated with the respective tribes and communities. The Indian community needs to address its problems, and it can best perform this task by addressing itself and engaging of new kinds of dialogue within tribes and between tribes. This statement is as true today as it was when Vine Deloria Jr. wrote it in 1999. It is especially true for those of us who are from communities facing challenges to our political sovereignty and, in some cases, to our very right to exist. It is up to us as tribes, communities in ways that are fundamentally different from other American communities and organizations, communities that are wholly defined by family relationships, to deal with our problems and move the dialogue forward in more productive directions. Thank you.
And yes, again, that was Cedric Woods, the second panelist on the Tribal Sovereignty Session held at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center on February 27, 2010. Part two of this series will be aired next time on Indigenous Politics, and that will feature the other three presenters on the panel, Betsy Conway, James Jackson, and Jackson King. You've been tuning in to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Ke Haolani Kawanui. My email address is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. Again, that's indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. And another reminder that all past episodes of Indigenous Politics are archived online. You can upload to your iPod or listen from your computer at your leisure. The website is indigenouspolitics.com. Again, that's indigenouspolitics.com for our complete audio archive. I want to acknowledge the stations that syndicate this show, including WNJR in Washington, Pennsylvania, WBCRLP in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, WETXLP in the Tri-Cities region of Tennessee, Virginia, and North Carolina, and WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Montauk, New York. If you know of a station that might like to syndicate Indigenous Politics, they can drop me a line at indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. And in closing, I would like to leave you with a selection by the Mystic River Singers. This is them at the drum doing the Mashantucket flag song. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.
Excuse me, my name is Ken Merrick Jr. and I'm the lead singer for the Mystic River Singers. They've asked us to come here and share a little bit of music and asked us to sing a flag song for, I know there's many different tribal nations represented here, and we have a wide different range of flag songs that we can sing. But this one that in particular that I'm going to share with you is the Mashantucket Pequot flag song, and it talks about the warriors bringing the eagle staff back with victory.